In a couple of days, last two weeks, I spoke about a very important theme about what the real concept is of Purim, you know, and why Purim is such a great holiday, and so on. And I talked about the whole concept of what legal means and what justice is. And what the Rav Shlomo did is he set us up to teach us that lesson, which is in many ways very critical. And like I pointed out, especially now with what's going on in America, we see, and by the way, we all see it's getting worse. There's an unbelievable betrayal of America to Israel, to the Jewish people. And besides all the anti-Semitism, I mean, it's hard to believe what is going on in, and this is supposed to be America. In any case, yeah. So in 4 days, actually, from now, today is Wednesday night. We have Purim. You know, so that was one theme that I dealt with and so on. You know, so I want to continue because there's a second theme, which is critical of Purim, and I want to talk about it tonight. So it's part two in terms of the major ideas of Purim and so on. Anyway, before I begin this year, I want to dedicate this year should be a blessing and a merit for the health and success of the families of Regina Bas Yosef Reuven and Yeshaya Ben Yisrael, Binyamin Wolf Ben Tzvi Hirsch, and Baruch Ben Binyamin Wolf. And they should only have Hatzlocha in the merit of the Shir. In any case, so tonight I want to talk about a theme which is interesting because I have never really found a satisfactory resolution to this problem. And what is the problem really? Amalek. We talk about Amalek, you know, that obviously Amalek became famous, you know, because right after the Jews left Egypt, Amalek, who was a tribe of ancient history, they attacked the Jews, as when they left Egypt, with the intent, of course, to destroy them. And Yehoshua fought them, and he weakened them, but didn't destroy them. And as we will see, that was by divine decree, not to destroy them. Which itself is very interesting. But the truth is, and I'll tell you something interesting, you know, if not for the fact that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, God, says in his Torah that this happened, that Amalek went to war against the Jewish people after they left Egypt, right? I would not believe it really happened. Because when you think about it in the context of nations that make war against other nations, it doesn't make any sense. It's very hard to imagine that this really occurred. You see? So that's number one, and which I will go through and so on, you know? So why is that? Well, the first thing is that people make a mistake, and I've heard this many times. Well, Amalek didn't believe in God. They didn't believe in a deity. They didn't believe in God, right? And here the Jews are coming out of Egypt with this belief, right? That makes no sense. First of all, there was no atheism in those days. All nations believed in God. Yeah, they believed in Avodah Zarah, true. But all nations believed in their, whatever their particular deity was. They believed in a God. Not only that, Egypt was filled with deities, Avodah Zarah, and we know that, you know. So the question is, so the Jews believe in God, so what? You believe in God, Amalek, so why do you want to kill the Jews? Like I said, there was no atheism, really. Atheism is basically a modern day institution that really came about in great measure through Darwin and science and the rise of science in the last couple of hundred years. But before that, the world was religious. You see, so if that's the case, what's the motive for Amalek to war with Israel? That makes sense. What's their motive? It wasn't for territory. Israel had no territory. They're just the whole nation of Israel came out of Egypt after being slaves. Slaves don't know any own anything. There was no territory that Amalek wanted to take over, which is usually why nations go to war. I mean, let's face it, what's the motive of nations that go to war, right? It's either to take over their territory, that's one idea, right? Or to conquer them and take tribute, money, which is why Rome took so much, because they wanted tribute from all these nations. So they want money, so that's the second motive, right? Why a nation will go to war. And the third reason is to protect itself because it's being attacked. Three reasons, you know. Other than that, what does it benefit a nation, really, right, to go to war? So the question is, what's the motive of Amalek? Jews believed in God. They believe in a deity. So what's your problem? So it's not your deity. So what? So it's very hard to find a motive that makes sense. Not only that, there's a second idea which doesn't add up. Do you know how much money it costs to go to war? You know, I remember I once read that when America went to war in Iraq, you know, and so on, it cost $1 billion a day. That's how much it cost. Because you have hundreds of thousands of soldiers, and guess what? You got to feed them, right? It costs a fortune. You got to transport the food, the supply lines. And the Medrash says that Amalek had to go through five countries to war with the Jews. So, could you imagine? They start from wherever they are, they go through five countries, and then they can war with the Jews, right? Do you have an idea how long the supply lines are for five countries? They have to have supply lines, right? So where do they get the money for this? That's millions, equivalent of millions and millions of dollars. And not only that, in terms of the supply lines, so you can say, well, maybe they can live off the land, you know, well, they'll take. But remember, the Jews were in a wilderness. So we're not looking here at different civilizations where they can go in and steal all the food from the different homes and so on. There were no nations. They're going through whatever, the Sinai Peninsula and whatever, and so on, you know. So wherever they're coming from, they're much less people. There's nobody to steal from, basically, you see. So where are they getting all the food? Like I say, the supply lines is an enormous amount of difficulty and money. So why are you going to war? You know how much money it costs you to do that? Makes no sense. And we don't even understand the motive. That's the second idea. Third idea, millions of Jews left Israel, left Egypt, right? We know 600,000 Jews left Egypt, correct? Right? 600,000 Jews above the age of 20, right? And we assume if they're above the age of 20, that they were married. So that's 1,200,000. And probably they had kids, especially we know in Egypt, they had six kids at one shot. So we're probably looking at 2, maybe 3 million Jews leaving Egypt. Well, how many Amalekis did you have, really? You know, if they're going to war with Israel, they have to have a lot of people. So could you imagine how big their army has to be to take on a nation? You know what I'm saying? Even if they were slaves, the sheer number of Jews is incredible. So Amalek didn't have that many people. So what is really going on here, right? So that's a third question. Fourth question is, what are they, crazy? The world knew that God destroyed Egypt. So obviously, God, the Ribbono Shel Olam, right, is on their side. He's their protector. So they automatically knew that it was a suicide trip, because they knew that the Ribbono Shel Olam, right, who protected Jews and created 10 miracles, right, and destroyed Egypt, is going to destroy them. So what, are they stupid? Doesn't even make sense. You're fighting not with Israel, you're fighting with a God that demonstrated what he can do to the Egypt, which the whole world knew, because this was like universal knowledge. So it's a suicide trip. So why are they doing this? You see? So therefore, when you think about it, it doesn't make sense why a nation would go to war with the Jewish people, you know, in light of all these questions that I asked. And then the last question, that's not the last question, but why does God hate them so much? Why? Because they hate Jews? I mean, take a look what's going around now. You know how many nations hate Jews? You know? But only by Amalek does it say that you have to destroy every man, woman, and child. So we see that there's an abiding hatred, right, that the Ribono Shel Olam has for Amalek. In fact, the Ribono Shel Olam says in the Pasuk, right, Ki Yorah Keisko, right? Right, that my kingdom, his hand is against the throne, because kiyod, his hand, al kase, is missing an aleph, kise. His hand is against the throne, kise, ko, which really should be yud ke vav ke, right? And it's a war, midodo, which means it's an eternal war, not eternal, but it's a war as long as we will live in Olam Hazeh. There's a war between God and Amalek, you see? But why? Because he hates Jews? Your nations kill Jews, right? Between the Persians, or the Romans, or the Babylonians, or the Assyrians. Because it's wholesale slaughter for thousands of years. So what is this abiding hatred which we see is more than any other nations? That is the question. In other words, what's the essential idea behind Amalek that gets the Ribono Shel Olam to hate them so much? It's a very important question. Obviously, it means that there's something unique about Amalek, right, that entitles them to be the special interests of the Ribono Shel Olam. The question is, what is it? And it really, in many ways, it's not easy to figure out. Like I said, because, you know, there are many nations that do what Amalek does. I mean, just take a look at the history of Europe for the last 1,000 years, between the Crusades, right? The expulsions, the Inquisition. Hey, Jews were killed left and right, you know, and the bubonic plague, the Black Death, where they used to go around and kill Jews and so on. So it's really a very important question for us to ask, you see. Anyway, so that's questions that we really have to ask. Very important. Also, when you look at the Megillah itself, you wonder about this, like Haman. Is he crazy? You know, the Jews, they're loyal citizens, and they provide an enormous amount of wealth to Persia. So why would anybody want to kill their tax base? That's really what they're doing. And so on. What's the logic of it? And what do I mean? For instance, Haman, who's a descendant of Amalek, it's difficult to understand this person. First of all, Mordechai doesn't bow. We see that in the story, right? So then he says to his people, who are these people? So they tell him he's a Yehudi. Then all of a sudden he decides to kill Mordechai, but not just Mordechai. Kill out all the Jews. Why? I mean, you don't like this guy because you felt he slighted your honor, and you want to kill him, whatever. I'm not that I understand it, but fine, you know. But why would you want to commit genocide because some guy didn't bow down to you? I mean, is he out of his mind? We're not talking about that they get nothing from the Jews. The Jews are loyal citizens, and there must have been, in fact, the Chazal tell us that was the last time that all the Jews were under the 127 Medinas, countries of Ahasuerus. So the Jews are providing an enormous amount of wealth. So because this guy didn't bow down to you, okay, so you're angry at him, fine. But why would you want to kill all the Jews? You know? So that's very interesting. What is going on in this guy's mind? I mean, Haman is not stupid, remember. He's the Grand Vizier. You can't be an idiot, although maybe you can, and aspire to such a high position, although today we see it's possible, right? Anyway, so the question is, why do you want to do that, you see? So that's the first very difficult thing to understand. The revenge, the motive for revenge, genocide? Because this guy didn't bow down? Second thing is, why does the Megillah keep repeating the Yichus, the genealogy of Haman? You know, he's Ben Hamdasa, Wagogi, and all that. It says that many times. You see? Okay, you got to say it once to identify who he is, fine. But why do you have to keep repeating yourself? That is the question, you know. So that's the second question. Then we have another question, which really is very puzzling. You know, he goes over to Ahasuerus after he decides to kill Mordechai and all the Jews, which he does, takes the ring, and decides that 13th of Adar, he's going to kill all the Jews, whatever. Right? But he's got to convince Ahasuerus. He's only Grand Vizier. He's not the emperor. He's not the king. You need a king for that, right? So what does he do? So he goes to Ahasuerus and tries to give him an argument. Now, Ahasuerus is not, I mean, we see that, you know, he's not stupid. You know, especially what's very important about Ahasuerus is he's not even really a legitimate king. He's not descended in any which way from kings. I think he was a major general that was victorious and therefore they made him king or whatever. So he doesn't have what's called direct lineage of kings. So he has to make sense. So Haman is trying to convince them to kill the whole nation again. And they contribute tremendously to the tax burden, right? What does he say? Well, this nation, right? They're different. They have different religion, different culture, different language. They're not like everybody else. That's what he says to Ahasuerus. And also to remove the idea that I'm now going to take away from your tax base, I give you 10,000 talents of silver, which is a lot of money. I think historians estimate that must have been worth like $100 million or something like that. Fortune of money. He's a very wealthy man in Haman, for obvious reasons. The corruption must have been incredible. But in any case, so Ahasuerus says, okay. He hands the ring over to Haman, and we know the story, of course, and so on. But you know what doesn't make sense? I don't understand. What was his argument? That the Jews are different, their language is different, culture, they stay by themselves. So what? It says in the Megillah that there was 127 countries. Do you know what that means? That means each one had their own language, their own culture. So anyway, there's 127 different, right, peoples. So the Jews are one of them. So what was the argument that he said to Ahasuerus? What was the argument? That they're different and so on. They have all kinds of differences. They're by themselves. I guarantee you, right, that can be repeated 126 times because they were the 127th. So the question is, what was the argument that he presented to Ahasuerus? Right? I'm telling you, it doesn't make sense when you think about that. Now, Ahasuerus, you know, there's an argument if he was a fool or whatever and so on and so forth, you know, but it doesn't sound like he was an anti-Semite. He did it for the cash, or however he convinced them. But it's not because he bore a hatred, you know, for the Jews. You see, so you can't really label him an anti-Semite, even though what he did was the height of anti-Semitism, to kill them for what? For money? Okay, but it wasn't because of ideology and so on, you see. Like Hitler, Yimach Shemai, in Germany, he did it because he hated the Jews, which I'll talk about, because it's a very important clue as to what Amalek is and Haman is. But in any case, so therefore we have a whole series of questions. I asked 8 questions, right? And there are many, many other questions and so on and so forth, which I'm going to try to attempt to answer and so on, you know. One of them is a very interesting question. Why is Purim 2 days? you know, basically what you're really commemorating is the victory of the Jews over Haman, or over this desire to commit genocide, right? So there are wars. There was attempts by the people to kill the Jews. So you have, so it ended on, for the rest of Persia, right? It ended on the 13th, so we celebrate the 14th. But it continued one more day in Shushan, right? So it ended on the 14th, so they commemorate the 15th. But the question is, why do you have 2 days? It's one war, right? It's one war, one idea. So why not just have one day, right? And you wait till the last day, and that was the 14th, right? And on the 15th, you'll have Shushan Purim for everybody. You see? So why do we have 2 days? It's unusual. 2 days for the same event, right? Which was an attempt to destroy the Jews. Why? Anyway, so I'm going to try to really deal with these questions and really try to answer them and to discover what the hidden theme is. Now, I want to tell you what, as far as I'm concerned, what the problem that Amalek has. Let's forget about Haman for a minute. Let's talk about Amalek. Because remember, Haman is an Amaleki, Amalekite. And he's therefore, as we will see, he wants to pick up the challenge that he felt was given to his nation called Amalek, which we will see. What exactly is going on by Amalek? In order to understand Amalek, you must understand mankind, the psychology of mankind. Now, I will tell you something very basic, very fundamental psychological concepts. Mankind, even though it doesn't look that way, is always concerned with God. Because man either wants to be God, right? All mankind wants to be God, which I'll talk about, or they want to kill God, or they want to defy God. Everybody wants to do that. That's what's called the hidden delusion. You know, we grow up with delusions of omnipotence. It's famous in psychology. All infants, when they're born, think that they're God because they don't distinguish an other. As they get older, they begin to realize, wait a minute, I'm not the only one, there's other. And they realize that they have to cater to reality and so on. But the problem is that they're left with a tremendous insecurity. Because everybody knows really how weak they are. And that reality requires a tremendous amount of challenges to survive. Survival is not simple. You know, it may look easy, but, you know, as time goes on, you realize, hey, wait a minute, right? It's very possible that the kid says that he could die, you know, because you got to eat, you got to breathe, you got to drink. Right? And you have to be able to pay for so many things that you need. You need shelter, right? You can't live outside, and so on, you know? So all humans realize how weak and vulnerable they are to the elements, and in general, to the difficulties of life. So therefore, there's always a delusion. Well, I don't have to worry. You see, I'm really God, or I can be a God, one of the gods, you know? Or and so on. But therefore, every person really wants to be able to overcome the difficulties that he sees. So therefore, he winds up with some kind of delusion that he's a superman, he's supernatural. It's very easy for him to begin to think of himself, right, in an abnormal way, a supernatural way, and so on. Anyway, without getting into all of that, that's what's called the basic existential fantasy of man. Okay? There's another idea which is related, which I will not go into, but it's very, very basic. And what is that? That all mankind is connected to God in some way. The problem is that when we are born, the Ribbono Shel Olam disconnects whoever you are. And everybody starts out with some type of neshama. A Jew will have a higher kind of neshama. But even a guy, doesn't make a difference, has a spiritual neshama. You see? So when a neshama is separated from God, when it comes down, it immediately feels what's called an existential inferiority, immediately, because it's disconnected from existence, because that's what God is, right? So as long as it was connected to God in whatever manner, right, before it was separated from God and put down into, encased in a soul, you know, it was okay. You know, there's no fear of its non-existence. See, that's why Malachim, the angels, they don't have this fear. They're not worried about existence because they feel or they're connected to God existentially. So they're okay, you see. It's like a kid, you know, a three-year-old kid holding the hand of his mother or father and therefore feels fine. Why do you think kids are always, they want to be next to their parents? Because they need to feel secure in their ability to exist. That's why. So as long as before we're born, we're connected to God, fine, you see. But what happens when God said, okay, it's your time to be born, to leave me and to come down to the earth and then find me again, right? And he disconnects the neshama, or if not disconnected, he doesn't allow the neshama to feel the connection to God anymore, right? Then immediately there's what's called an existential inferiority. Very important concept, right? And therefore, in a certain sense, we are born with a tremendous feeling of inferiority, and therefore we begin to develop that delusion or fantasy of omnipotence. Now, I'm not even talking about psychological inferiority. I'm talking about existential inferiority, which is spiritual, which we automatically feel even though we're not aware of why, you see. And that's one of the reasons why we have this need to either feel like we are God, or we are a God, or we want to kill God, be Him, right? Or we want to defy God to prove that we are immortal and that we are omnipotent. That's the origin of the concept of what man really wants. The proof of all this is when the Nachash, the snake, wanted to convince Chava to eat from that tree. He said, I want to tell you something, Chava, because I know what you're thinking. What is your basic need? To be God, right? He knew that from an existential standpoint. Obviously, there wasn't a psychological reason, but and because they had everything. But from an existential standpoint, he knew that man automatically has a vulnerability, right? Where he's insecure and he feels inferior, you see? So therefore, he told her, V'yisim kelokim, and you'll be like God. You know, why didn't you tell her the fruit tastes great? Or something like that. He didn't. Was that the only argument he had to offer to entice her? Yeah. And you will be like God. What does this have to do with this? Because he immediately knew the Satan, because he knows the psyche of man, that the greatest need of man is to feel like a somebody, to feel as if he can exist. The greatest fear a human being has is what? Self-preservation. That underlies every single drive and need. And I'm not going to go into it, so you don't realize how basic that is. That every moment of our lives, we're always wondering and we're always anxious about our mortality, that we can die at any moment. When we see that, or how many times? Some guy's crossing the street and bam, oh, he gets hit by a car and he's dead. Or he gets a heart attack or whatever, right? And we're always conscious of that vulnerability, of that mortality, you see. But I'm telling you that even without the obvious ideas that we can die because we realize existence is not easy, it's a challenge, there's the existential anxiety, you see, because we are separate from God. Very important concept. And therefore, the Satan knew that, and he said to Chava, Adam's wife, Yisim Kelokim, and guess what? This fruit will do it for you. Wow, that's exactly what I need. He told her the exact medicine that she needed. So of course she grabbed it. And she obviously, even though the Chumash doesn't say it, she repeated that to Adam. Because how else did she get him to eat from that tree? She repeated it The problem was that she knew it was false, because once she took a bite out of it, she didn't feel anything closer to being a god. So she deceived Adam. I don't want to get into what that means. She lied to him, obviously, and so on. In any case, so therefore we have in us the need to be God, you see. Ah, so here's the problem. Once you understand, you know, the what's called the primus of Adam, and what he must have, you see, you could see that. You know, you think about that, Adam wanted to be God. There you are. And that Adam is the fundamental human, right? And then you have the guys in the marble, the flood. What were they doing? They were defying God. They did whatever they wanted. They took all your possessions, Gezela, right? Everything. They did whatever they wanted. So they had the need to feel like God by defying God. And then who did you have? You had Paroi. And Paroi felt he was a god. And then you had the Dor HaFlogah, the guys who built the Tower of Babel. They wanted to kill God. See, and all these people, they're all preoccupied with, in some way, with God. To be, to kill, to defy, you know, or to aspire. I mean, come on. The beginning of Bereishis, it's all about these guys. Because that's what the essence of mankind is. And I'm telling you, you don't even realize that. But every minute of your waking life, unconsciously, how am I going to exist? Mortality is the existential, fear that we all have. And I told you it has two sources. Either it's spiritual in nature because you're separated from God. The second thing, it's psychological. If you had parents who treated you miserably, they increase your inferiority, and that's psychological inferiority, and so on. But anyway, without getting into that, and so on, you know. So we realize that. So therefore, we now come to an incredible dilemma. What's the dilemma? Because if I have to feel that I am in control, and that I can exist, that I can survive, and so on, right? Then I have a problem. Because if I'm religious, and I believe in God, and I am subject to His authority, I got problems. That means I'm a nobody. That's what it means, right? You're not who you think, right? You're subject to the will of God. You see? But wait a minute. You ever wonder, why does mankind hate authority? You ever notice that? If you work for somebody, deep down you hate the guy. Why? Because he proves to you on a daily basis that he's somebody and you're nobody, because you're subject to his will. You don't do his job, he fires you. Hey, you thought you were somebody big? Of course not. We hate authority. We're always thinking of, and not that we consciously think about that, don't make that mistake, but deep down unconsciously, we have the desire to rebel, you see, to do what we want to do, and that proves that we're a somebody. That's the psychological origin of the concept called being, feeling like you're somebody. That's why we have a drive of self-worth. We are somebody. That's the origin of that drive. I don't want to get into the whole concept of self-worth and so on, but that's the origin, is survival, if we have to feel as somebody. So here's the problem. If I believe in religion, if I believe in God, right, it means I'm a nobody, basically. It means I'm completely dependent on the Rabbanu Shlodim. Uh-oh. That's dangerous to my desire or my need to feel like somebody, because I'm not in control. You see, there's somebody else in control. He's somebody. So what do people do? And now you begin to understand something very, very interesting. That's why all religions, and you begin to understand something, have what's called an exit plan. Where they, what's called in English, they have their cake and eat it too. What does that mean? It means, okay, I believe in God, but in some way, right, I will neutralize God in some way where I can express my superiority. You see? Where I feel like somebody. It's an amazing concept. And mankind, and I'm going to now give you a whole series of religions in that sense, where you see clearly that there's an exit plan, which means that it allows for you to do whatever you want, you see? And so you can feel like a somebody, even though you believe in God. It's amazing. That's the psychological concept of religion. And from that, you will understand the true root of anti-Semitism. Why do people hate the Jews? Which really makes no sense. I mean, the Jews don't do anything to today. What do you hate them so much for? And it's not even rational. In any case, let's take a look. Okay, so the first defense or mechanism or strategy, I should say, that mankind has is that, okay, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in God. Oh, hey, that was great. I don't believe in God, so I can do whatever I want. There is no God, right? So therefore, I can do whatever I want. So that's strategy number one, to be an atheist. But it's very hard to be an atheist. You know, as far as I'm concerned, you're a real schlamassel if you're an atheist. Why? Because the greatest evidence for a supreme being is the unbelievable complexity of organisms. It's unbelievable. I mean, anybody who goes through, there are books written on that and so on, of the incredible complexity, there's a beetle that produces liquid inside of it that's 200 degrees Fahrenheit. That's boiling water. Yet it's not consumed. And what it does is if it's threatened, it sprays this liquid on another insect to protect itself. How in the world did it come up with that strategy that 200 degree temperature can protect it? Every organism has unbelievable complexity. You see, so you really can't be an atheist unless you're so blind and you're so dishonest. Because how in the world did this come about? It can't come about by chance. Chance doesn't have an intelligence. It's pure statistics and so on, you see. So you really can't be an atheist. So what do you become? Agnostic. Agnostic means, well, I don't not believe in God, and I don't believe in God. I already know. You see, and unless you prove to me that there's a God, I will assume there isn't, so I don't have to listen to God. Prove that there is a God. So that's an agnostic. So that's a second strategy, that a person can do what he wants. Then there's a third strategy. It's hard to do that, you got to believe in a God. So we come up with Aristotle. Aristotle held there was a God, but he holds that the God of Aristotle, his God, has nothing to do with the universe, except that it was the first cause. It was God leaves mankind alone and says, hey, you're on your own, do whatever you want. That's Aristotle's God. Hey, that's fabulous. That means there is a God who caused the everything to come into being, right? But he has no demands. It has nothing to do with us. So hey, you go your way, I go my way, and that's the end of the story. That's a brilliant strategy to avoid entangling yourself with the dictates of God, right? So therefore, that is a third strategy, right? Okay, but then that's hard to believe that God has nothing to do with mankind at all, or the universe and so on. So then we have Persia, Zoroastrian. Well, there are two gods. There's a God of good and there's a God of evil. There's actually a God of evil. So I say like this, listen, if I'm alone, I can't fight God. But guess what? I'm going to become his chassid, the God of evil. So I can do whatever I want, because guess what? He's just as powerful as the God of good, and he'll protect me. It's also a brilliant strategy, where I can do whatever I want, even if it's evil, and my God, who is evil, right, will protect me. There you are. So I found a protector, my guardian knight, so to speak. And that's a strategy. But you see how it's all an exit where I can do what I want, you see? Okay, so that's number four. Then there's number five, which is a way that was taken by the ancients. And that's polytheism. Well, I believe in many gods. I mean, you look at the Greeks and the Romans, mostly the Greeks and so on. You look at the Greek mythology, it was unbelievable. They had gods, they had women gods, they had demigods, right? They had guys that were really born of gods who raped women and whatever. I don't even get into that. You know, there was these kinds of gods. There's a whole slew of these guys, you see? So the advantage of that is what? Is that you can pick and choose. Well, I'm a devotee of that god, and that god does what I really want to do, you see? Because there's so many gods to choose from. Hey, what a selection, you see? So basically, these gods are doing something that I want to do, you see? So in a certain sense, polytheism protects you because you pick and choose whoever you want. See, again, it's an exit plan where I could do what I want and still believe in a super deity and so on. And that's the concept of polytheism. Very interesting strategy, but that's what it serves. Anyway, so that is number five, you see. Then there's another strategy. You know, what do I have to worry about God for? I'm going to have my God be immoral. He himself will commit immorality. That's what that's what the Greeks did. They had their main god, who's Jupiter or Zeus, right? And this was a guy who was going around raping women. And there's four that he raped. Io, Callisto, Ganymede, whoever they were and so on, you know. Hey, if Zeus can do it, so why can't I do it? That's exactly what I want to do, right? I want to take somebody else's wife, right? So that was a brilliant strategy where they had God doing the very things that they want to do, you see? So Adrabah, my God does it, right? And there's a mitzvah in the Torah, Lihidamas Bedrochav, right? To imitate God's ways. And that's exactly what I'm going to do. Wow, what a strategy. Well, you are actually imitating God, who is immoral, or I should say amoral, whatever. But you had the whole Greeks doing this. Well, they committed, they were jealous, they were warlike, they were hostile. It was great, because I can, on the contrary, you know, I'm imitating them, and so on. So that was an incredible strategy. But look what the Greeks did, you see, it was incredible. So that was... That's number six. Then there's a seventh strategy where the God is not necessarily immoral, but the avoido is immoral. What God wants me to do is immoral. You see, give me an example. What's a good classic idea of this, you know? Well, you know, it's not moral to kill people. But what happens if God tells me to kill people, right? So I'm serving my God. I'm worshiping my God by killing people, you see, and that's what when you see many religions, for instance, the Inquisition, right? What are you killing people for? What are you killing Jews for and burning them at the stake for? Right? Because my God, whether it be Yeshu or whoever it was, right? These guys are guilty of death. But where do you see that? And so on, you know, why not just let them be? Oh, no, you can't do that, right? Because my God says they deserve death. So what they did is they made it that the service to their God involves exactly what you want to do. You see, in many ways, I hate to say it, but Islam is that. Islam, in the Quran, it says, right, where Allah, that's whatever, says, you know, if you see a Jew behind a tree or whatever that is, kill him. So it's a mitzvah to kill a Jew. Why? Because that's what God says. And I'm doing the will of God by doing this or whatever he says. You see, so their hostility, their rage, you see, is all commanded by God. That's their avodah. You see, that they can do whatever they want. You see, by having the service of God actually immoral and evil, you see. So that is a strategy that religions take and so on. Then you have a religion, which is basically Christianity, where God changed his mind, you know. Originally thought that the Torah, which he gives to the Jews, can be observed by the Jews. But he realized in the end, too difficult, right? So therefore, Christianity abrogated, which means removed or canceled out the Torah, wow, and all he said was, believe in me, you don't have to do any mitzvahs, just believe in me. And if you believe in me, you get the future world and so on. God changed his mind. Wow, what a strategy. That's basically what Christianity says, right? That God changed his mind and he replaced the Jews with the non-Jews. And therefore, you look at it, okay, what was the change? The change was he removed all the laws, basically. He basically removed all the mitzvahs, the Taryag mitzvahs. And those are the mitzvahs that tell me, no, you can't do something. Those are the mitzvahs that make me feel inferior because they control me. You see? So he changed his mind. They actually got God in that sense. They invented a religion where God changed his mind. And therefore, you could do whatever you want, basically, you know, or there's only a minimal things that you have to do to satisfy me. Incredible. Again, there it is. That's the exit, you see. And that's the basically what Christianity is, right? So that's a strategy. Okay. And then we come to, I think it's number 9. This is really a brilliant piece of work. Wait a minute. I sin, right? Now, normally, according to Judaism, the only one who can forgive you, basically, is God, right? But you know what we'll do? The priest can forgive you. Payment of cash. You see, it's called indulgences. That's one of the reasons why Luther, you know, put up that, what kind of business is? He realized the absurdity of all this, right? But for who knows how many years, if a guy wanted, he would sit down with his priest or whatever, and he says, okay, I'm going to confess. And the priest has the ability to forgive, right? He has the ability to be mechaper. You can't do that. Why? Because once a man can mechaper, can forgive you, guess what? Pay him off. Because everybody has needs. So if you know exactly how to press the right button, there it is. You're forgiven. And he has the power to forgive. That's called an indulgence. So after a while, they were making a fortune, the Catholic Church, right? The guy would came, you know, I'm really sorry, you know, but I raped somebody else's wife. So the guy would say, okay, of course, $1,000 for the kapara, for the atonement, right? And he would give it to you, you know, and you were hoping maybe on that week there would be a sale, that if you did it again to another woman, right, it would only cost you $500 because it's a sale on that week and so on, right? But it was an indulgence, which is, when you think about it, it's brilliant. Because all men can be bribed, we all know that. It's just a matter of, it's never amount if it can be bribed, it's how much. That's really all it's about. And that was a brilliant way. Finally, even Luther recognizes this is ridiculous, the concept of indulgences. And that's how the Catholic Church became so wealthy, because everybody was paying priests to, in confession, to forgive them. Anyway, I've just laid out, I think it's 9 different exit strategies that we can feel good about ourselves at the same time as believing in God. You see? Very important idea. And then, of course, we come to the last strategy. Well, there is no strategy. God says, do this. God cannot be bribed. Nobody else can do it, forgive you, right? God knows everything. You can't fool him where all of a sudden he doesn't know. By the way, there are people that hold that God doesn't know everything. You know, and God allows that. You're like Bilam. Oh, God doesn't even know, you know, what's happening and so on. You know, because God asks him, who are these people? Uh-oh. You see? So a person could say, well, if God doesn't know, it's, I can do whatever I want. And hopefully he won't know. And so on. Well, God is not everywhere. You see? Those are other strategies. But Judaism comes along. And now we understand something very important. Why did Nimrod hate Avraham Avinu? I mean, Avraham Avinu believed in one God. So what's your problem? You believe in many gods, and Avraham Avinu believes in one God, right? So what do you do with the guy? You throw him into the Kivshon HaEsh. You throw him into a furnace, right? That was the first test of Avraham Avinu. He took Avraham, he threw him into a furnace. And God, of course, saved them, which was an absolute miracle, and so on, you know. But the question is, what's your problem, Nimrod? It's not that you don't believe in God and he does. You also believe in a God, except you believe in different gods, or you believe in many gods. So Avraham Avinu believes in one God. What's your problem? But here's the problem. And this is the beginning of our understanding of what Amalek is. What was the problem? Because the God of Avraham Avinu is bad news. Why? Because he doesn't provide an exit. The God of Avraham Avinu, first of all, is only one God. There is no many gods. So that's it. There's only one. Not only that, that God is moral. He's just. Right? You can't bribe him, right? And he actually tells you things you can't do. You see, he's actually giving you a code of behavior. And you're held accountable to that code of behavior. And like I said, he's moral, he's just, right? He's righteous, and he's holy. He wants you to do stuff. Hey, I have a different inclination. What do you mean I can't do this? I can't do that. Why not? So the problem was that Avraham Avinu introduced a God, or I should say a belief system, which does not allow an exit or some what's called downtime where I could do what I want. You see? So Nimrod realized we cannot have that type of religion where there's no downtime, where I can't do what I want. You see? I can't be that way. I must kill this man. You see, that's the beginning of our understanding of what is always going on. This is the answer to the question. You see, it starts with Avraham Avinu, because that's what he introduced. What Avraham Avinu introduced was the concept called, no, you can't do it. You see, so he reminds everybody that you are a servant of God, or you are dependent on him, you see, and there's no way to get around it. God does not take a vacation, and you have no way of getting around this, you see, because the God of the Jews is a God that says no. He has a code of ethics, a code of morality. He's got a code of behavior. Why? Because the God of the Jews is what? He's righteous. He's just, he's holy, you see. And he has an absolute code. And guess what? You are held accountable. Right, in the end, he's gonna look at you and ask you, did you observe my commandments? And where are you gonna run? That's why Nimrod wanted to kill Avraham Avinu, you see, because Avraham Avinu violated. And that's why we understand Chazal. Chazal say, why is Har Sinai, the mountain of Sinai, right? Why is it called Sinai? So the Gemara, the Chazal tell us unbelievable, because Sinai, Mount Sinai, in which the Torah was given, right, is when sinner descended to the world. Hatred, sinner, from the word sinner, descended to the world. That's what Chazal say. Therefore, it's called Sinai, because that's when sinner descended. But the question is why? Because until then, there was no such thing as no. You see, I can always get around the command of God, like all the strategies that I outlined, and so on. But once you had Sinai, hey, the commandments are absolute, and I'm held accountable, and it's against my will. I need an out. I need to feel like I'm in control. You see? So that's why it's called Sinai, from the word sinner, you see? And that was the beginning of the hatred of the Jewish people. There you are. The Jews introduced the whole concept of what? Of authority. What I'm telling you is a fundamental understanding of anti-Semitism, you see. And from that began anti-Semitism. Because in the mind of any non-Jew, the one who gave the Bible the one who introduced the whole Western civilization moral code, really is the Bible. The Bible, the Torah, is the greatest book ever sold, you know, and most people read it. And many religions are based on it. You know, Islam is based on the Torah. Christianity is based on the Torah. And there's so many different religions that have as part of them the ideas of the Torah. But what essentially is the Torah? No, you can't do what you want. You got to follow a code of ethics. It's a very, very important concept. Mankind cannot tolerate hearing the word no. And the Jews really introduced that because, like I say, Avraham Avinu was the first one to come up with this concept. Wait a minute, there's only one God, so forget about playing God off against God and so on, you know. But the God of Avraham is righteous, is holy, is just, you see, and he's got a code of behavior. And you're held accountable. He will actually come after you and judge you. And there will be consequences, reward or punishment. Nobody wants to hear that. Don't tell me this. And you mean there's no downtime? I can't deviate at all? No, you can't. Judaism doesn't say, well, you know, on this day you can do whatever you want. There's no such thing as, you know, do whatever you want day and so on, right? That's the beginning of Sinah, you see. And Nimrod realized this. So you can't have this. What do you mean destroying all the other idols? Because you hold there's only one God. Oh no, you can't do this to us. I need many gods to be able to get away and do whatever I want. Now we begin to understand, right, what Amalek is, right? And which is very, very important idea. What did I ask, you know? What was I really asking? Amalek, you know? It doesn't make sense. Was he going after the Jews? They believed in God, and he believes in God. So what are you trying to kill him for? Ah, that was the same concept as Nimrod, right? Yeah, they believe in God, but their God, their ideology is different than your ideology. Your God is a God that you can do whatever you want. His God is a God where you're held to strict observance, you see. And they realize that. We don't want this kind of God. We cannot tolerate this type of religion. So we are going to kill you. Could you imagine? And therefore, their desire to be able to do whatever they want was so great. And therefore, they realized the only way to stamp out this ideology or this type of religion is we must kill the Jews. Even though it's going to cost us a fortune, even though it's basically a suicide trip. It's really what it is. But we must kill them. We have to show in some way. That's called Mesiras Nefesh. You see, they were in many ways the first ones to be Moshe Nefesh, to stamp out Judaism. But the key is because they want to rebel against God and don't do this to us. You see, and that answers the question. That's why they are unique. That's why God says, you know, I'd rather have somebody who worships Avodah Zarah because at least he believes in a God, right? But these guys, they believe in a God. But it's a mockery, because they do whatever they want. They mock the whole concept of a supreme being. And that I will not tolerate. You see, you can't have that. You don't want to believe in me, you want to believe in an Avodah Zarah, idol worship. Not that it's fine. Okay, I can hear it. You know, because at least you believe in a supreme being. But to believe in a supreme being and then to laugh at his laws in the sense that I do what I want, all I need to do is create the strategy, you can't do that. That makes a mockery of the whole concept of a supreme being, right, that has rules and regulations at some point. And you know where you see that? Which is very interesting. Where does the Torah indicate that? You see? So what is so offensive to God is not only that ideology, but that they're willing to commit suicide for that ideology. That was so incredible. And you know where you see that? Because it says in the Pasuk, what does it say? Mochoi Emcha will surely blot out the name of Amalek, right? I have to blot them out. You see, I have to blot out this concept, right? That they can destroy my demands, right, and kill all the Jews, and even though they know they're going to die, I have to destroy that concept. So you know what it says? Ki yod. God says, well, what's the problem? Ki yod. Because the hand of Amalek, Al-Kais, which is the word Kisei, the Aleph is missing, because their hand is against the throne of God. Kisei Ka. Now, wait a minute. It should say their hand is against God. They defy me in the sense that they say there is no God. But it doesn't say that. It says that their hand is against the throne of God. What's a throne? The throne is a symbol of what? Of his sovereignty. That's what it is. The throne is the authority of God. The sovereignty. That's what Amalek is, you see. And God actually says that. Therefore, this type of religion, ideology, or this type of people, I must kill, blot them out. That to such an extent, we have to kill their possessions, their cattle, because God does not want to say, hey, that cattle used to belong to a guy, he was an Amaleki. No, God does not even want their name mentioned. That's how dangerous that theology is to Judaism or any religion. You see, that's what Amalek is the whole concept of destroying the true sovereignty of God, where we can bend them to our will. You see, we can tell him what to do. We can dictate the terms. And you know where you see this? Which is really incredible. Hitler, Yimach Shemoy. Why did Hitler hate the Jews? I mean, obviously the man is very disturbed. I mean, whatever. I mean, a guy used to be a painter, wall hanger, whatever he was and so on, you know. What do you hate these guys for? Well, first of all, Hitler is probably, it's far as, and you see that from codes, Hitler was a Gilgal of Haman. Without going into the famous code that his 10 ministers are really equal to the 10 sons of Haman and so on, you know. There's a whole code about that. But in any case, the main idea is that Hitler hated the Jews. Why? So he writes about it in Mein Kampf. Hitler was a bright guy. He wasn't stupid. He wrote in 1923 a book called Mein Kampf, My Struggle. And in the book he writes why he hates the Jews. Because the Jews gave the world a conscience. Right? Means no. That's what a conscience means. You know, all of a sudden, hey, you mean I can't do this? Right, you can't do this. And he hated the Jews for that. You see? Because they held they were Aryan, right? The Superman, right? Blonde hair, blue eyes, Nietzsche, and so on, the Superman, and so on and so forth. That's absolute Gaiva. That's God, that's the man God that he believed that the Germans were. What country has Deutschland, Deutschland über alles? You ever hear the national anthem? You know? Germany, Germany over everybody. Excuse me, why do you have to be over everybody? You know, you're part of mankind. Why do you have to be over everybody? Because you guys are sick. That's why. You guys are megalomaniacs. You know, it's not enough to be part of the Brotherhood of Nations. No, 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 no. You have to be Deutschland, Deutschland, über alles. That's the national anthem. That's a megalomaniacal, what do you call it, anthem and so on, you see? Because that's what they were. And Hitler was that, even though he was Austrian, right? But Austria is Germany, by the way. It's part of Germany and so on, you know. So that's why he hated the Jews. Now, wait a minute. But I'm saying that what? That the essential idea of Amalek is not just to hate the fact that there's no exit, but to be willing to die for that. Well, did that happen? Let me tell you something. Many years ago, I read a book called The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William Shirer. Long book. But anyway, I read it. And there were certain parts of that book that really caught my eye. One of them is at the end of the war, the Germans were losing. It was obviously they were losing to the Allies, right? So obviously, what do you do? So the generals approached. He brings this down, by the way. It's historical. So the German generals approached Hitler. And they said, we're losing the war, right? So he asked them, what's the problem? Why, you know? So they told him, because we need more soldiers in the front. And what you're doing is you're taking all the railroad cars to ship the Jews to the concentration camps. So we can't ship soldiers to the front. What are you doing? You know, which is more important, to kill the Jews, or to and therefore to lose the war, or to fight the enemy and to win the war? I mean, you yourself said that your Third Reich is going to be 1,000 years, right? You're not even going to last a couple of months. So you know what Hitler did? I mean, they presented a very nice argument and said, excuse me, you know, you're a traitor to Germany. How could you put the destruction of the Jewish people at a higher level of priority than the salvation and the continuation of the German Reich? And you know what Hitler told them? Get lost. He didn't care. What does that show you? There you are, the Mesiras Nefesh, their hatred, where I'm willing to die to destroy that Shita that the Jews have made us into wimps. Catholicism, he saw as a wimpy religion, right? Because they have a conscience. No, you can't do this. Why did the Jews do that? We are Aryan. Don't tell us no. You see, they gave us a conscience. They have made us into wimps. That's what Hitler said. It's Mamash HaMolek. You see, and he was willing to give up the Third Reich to kill every Jew. In fact, we know when the, not the Wehrmacht so much, but when the SS, as soon as they entered a city, what did they say? We're the Jews. It's the first thing they did. Is they gathered, they collected all the Jews, forced them in the middle of the city, whatever, and then they shipped them off to the concentration camps, or they didn't even wait. They just killed them in the forest, right? They had them dig the graves, right? And everybody stripped, whatever, and they put a bullet through their head. They didn't even wait, and so on. Because that was the priority, right? Why? Because Hitler is the classic Amaleki. That's really who he was. And there are things that prove that. There's a code that demonstrates that, you know, of who they were and so on. Therefore, this is a very, very important idea. Man does not want to be restricted. He doesn't want to be told no, you see. And he's always looking for ways where he can dominate and violate the laws, you see. And just to understand, I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, you know, when Avraham Avinu came to Avimelech, right? He saw, you know, so he told Sarah, I want you to tell him that you're my sister or else he'll kill me, you know, if you tell him you're my wife, because he'll want to take you. So that's what they did. And finally, somehow Avimelech realized, hey, because God performed the miracle and he blocked all the orifices of all the bodies of Avimelech and his whole palace. So he comes running back to Avraham Avinu and says, what are you doing? So Avraham Avinu told him, I told her to save him, she's my sister, or else you're going to kill him. Kill me. That's what he said. So Avimelech says to Avraham Avinu, what are you talking about? I don't do this kind of stuff. We're civilized people. We don't do this kind of stuff in this country. So Avraham Avinu told him a profound understanding. He told him, you don't understand something. You need, and that's really what he's saying, you need in some way, no matter what your moral code is, you cannot be told no. Mankind cannot be told no, really. So you're always going to look around for a way to get out of your own laws, because you really want to take my wife. For whatever reason, pretty woman and so on, you know. So that's your nature. You don't understand, which is a profound understanding. Man always seeks to violate a code of behavior given by somebody else because he needs to prove himself that he is somebody, you see. So he doesn't have to worry about the existential inferiorities that he has. And therefore, you're going to look for a way, right, to receive a bribe. You see, and the bribe is that you inherently, intuitively need to say, no, I'm not going to accept your no. It's part of your nature. You have no idea how profound that is. Because what Avraham Avinu is really saying, so you can say, wait a minute, but he said, we don't do this. He says, no, I saw there's no fear of God in this place. And as long as there's no fear of God, which you're not afraid of any accountability, this is your nature to violate codes of ethics. Because you need to do that. And so on, that's part of your nature. So of course, I saw there's no fear of God. What does that say? That mean, and that we now understand what's going on in America, right? Why is America obviously violating the laws? What they're doing to Trump is a mockery. We all see that. You have to laugh at the court cases that they're bringing Trump. And it's not just Trump. It's everybody associated with Trump. And it's all the injustices that America does. It's unbelievable. You see? And the question is why? Because mankind cannot be told no. And they are going to break the laws. They'll find a legitimate reason, or they'll think it's legitimate. Right. Why? Because every politician is a crook. I will repeat that. You don't realize mankind are crooks. That's the nature of a man, is to violate the no and to do what he wants. Now, so the question is, wait a minute. So what else can we do? And the answer is, there's only one remedy. And that is, fear God. That's the only hope you have. If you have religion, you will be moral, you will be upright, you will be just, right? And you will be righteous because you are accountable to God. That's your guarantee, you see? And that's what Avraham Avinu said. I took a look in this place and there's no fear of God. Wait a minute. There's no fear of God. It's over with. That's all. This is the problem. So what Avraham Avinu is saying is that all politicians are what? Are crooks. They're all deviant unless they fear God. That you should know one thing. The most important nature or characteristic of a politician is, does he have a moral code or not? Because if he doesn't have a moral code, guess what? He's going to want many things that the law says no. You can't take that. What do you mean, take? What do you mean no? You know, it's like that senator, is not, I don't want to mention his name, you know, he took gold bars from Egypt. What if he had, oh, that isn't so. Because how could you say no to gold bars? Right? And I understand him, right? Because all mankind is vulnerable to this. That's why the greatest or the most important characteristic of a politician is to do what? Is to fear God. Is to know that in the end of time, you're going to have to face God. And he's going to ask you, you know, I gave you a privilege to do what? To be head of a government. To help people survive. To make them happy. It's a tremendous chesed. You don't realize what I gave you. I gave you the ability to collect unbelievable reward because you will make it easier for people to survive, right? What'd you do? All you did was take the cash, or you took the bribes, or the guy paid for a vacation, like what's happening in Georgia, or whatever. That's all you did. What kind of business is this? You see? And of course, what's going to happen to them? We know that. God is going to slam the books against them. And they're finished. You see? So you don't realize how profound Avraham Avinu's statement was. He defined the true nature of man and the true nature of every politician. Why? Because a politician can get away with it. Huh? These guys know how to get around. You know, they know all the deviant ways, for whatever it takes to get the law on their side so he can collect. They all do that. You ever wonder how does a politician, when he leaves office, he's only making, whatever, 100, 200 grand a year, and then why a guy, after he leaves office, the guy becomes a multimillionaire? How in the world did he do that? And the answer is, of course, because when he gets out, right, it's all about bribes. He can inform on how to deviate from the law and so on, you see. Any case, what we're looking at is a very important concept of Purim. This is Amalek. That's what Amalek is. We cannot tolerate your statement of no. So we will get around it. At the same time, we'll believe in God. You see? And that's what's called the dilemma of mankind. It's a dilemma. if I believe in God, I'm going to be suffering from anxiety or whatever, you know. And if I don't believe in God, well, I do believe in God, you see, because the logic of complexity is much too great of a logic, an argument, to deny it, you see. So mankind has found, and I've just told you, 9 different ways of the strategy. Actually, I told you more than 9 different ways that there be people that hold that God doesn't know everything or God isn't every place and so on. So there's many more strategies. But leave it up to mankind. They're brilliant to figure out how to deviate from the code of behavior and so on, you know? But this is our Moloch. The difference between our Moloch and everybody else is not just their mockery of the laws of God, but it's their willingness to die for that idea, the Mesiras Nefesh. And they were. They're willing to die and spend a fortune, you see. And that's, now we understand Haman. I asked you 3 questions on Haman. The first question was, why after they told Haman that he's Jewish, did he decide to kill everybody? You know why? Because all of a sudden he said, the guy's Jewish? He says, wait a minute, doesn't make sense. Why? Because, right, ask yourself, what should he have done, Mordechai? He should have bowed in front of me. Why? Because that would have given him a possibility of gaining my favor, right? That was a benefit to him. But he didn't take it. He didn't bow. Therefore, his fear of God was greater than his need to benefit from me. Yeah, but wait a minute, who does that kind of sad? He couldn't say no. He couldn't remove the no. You see, who does that? The Jews. You mean those guys are still around practicing this kind of religion? I got to wipe him out. Not just him. I got to take up the tradition of my ancestors that wanted to kill the Jews. You see, that's why I have to kill Mordechai and all the Jews. What he says, I got to take up their cause. Now it makes sense. Because he wanted to wipe out that ideology that the Jews bring. That there's a code of behavior that's absolute. See, now it makes sense. That's why he wanted to kill the Jews. Because he says, I'm the inheritor. I'm Amaleki. I want to take up their challenge and kill all the Jews. To wipe out that ideology. That's the first question. Second question I ask is, wait a minute, you know, why does the Megillah always saying the word, the Yichus of Amalek? And the answer is because he's doing it because of the Yichus. It's not only that he wants to kill the Jews because he doesn't want to hear the word no and so on. But the Megillah goes out of its way to say many times, you know, Haman ben Hamdasa, Agogi and so on, because to tell you that he's not doing this only because of himself, his own hatred, his personal hatred. He's doing this because he's taking up the tradition and the challenge of his nation. And let me tell you who his nation is again. Again and again, that's part of why he's doing it. And the third idea, what was the statement to Achashverosh? What do you mean? There's 126 countries that also differ, right? So what's your argument about the Jews? It's ridiculous. And the answer is, that's what Haman said. You don't understand. The Jews are different than the other 126. All the other 126 have found ways to exit. They have strategies. You know, they can live with God and they can live on what they want to do. The Jews are the only ones that the code of behavior is absolute. They will destroy us because we cannot have such an ideology, a belief system. You see? They must be destroyed. Same concept as Nimrod. And that is the concept of not only Nimrod, but what Avraham Avinu said, and Amalek, and now Haman. It's one idea, and that's ultimately a profound lesson, that we're all bribed. We all want to feel like we're somebody. That's the origin of the greatest psychological need of all, self-worth. You see? But that's the problem. But the Baruch Hashem doesn't want that. What the Baruch Hashem says is, you don't understand. You are self-worth. Why? Because I am behind you. I am your existence. You see? And you need to believe that. So it's a paradox. If you believe in God, that basically you are his servant, right? And you're connected to him, and that he is God, he is existence, you have nothing to worry about. So the way to arrive at that is what's called his batlus. You are nobody. You believe in nobody, that I'm everybody. You will survive for eternity. It's a paradox. It's really what it is. And that's the difference between Judaism and everything else. In any case, we now understand with some very important what the problem with Hitler was. Same idea. They all fall for the same theme. Don't tell me no. And that's why Sinai is called Sinner. And that is the origin of anti-Semitism. That's why they hate us. Because we're the guys who introduced the word no. You see? And they never forgave us for that. You see? And that's why there have been so many attempts to destroy us. And that's the what's called the eternal hatred of the Jew. Because we remind humanity of the giving of the Torah. You see? Because when you look at a Jew, immediately what do you think about? The Bible. We are the ambassadors of God. And this is the problem. That's why they hate us. That's the real reason for anti-Semitism. That we are associated in everybody's mind, right? As the ones who gave the world a conscience and so on. Anyway, that's a very important theme besides the theme of the last 2 weeks which I gave, the concept of laws and so on. But it's a very important idea, and this is really what a Moloch is, and that's what we have to remember. You know, the laws of God are righteous, they are just, and they are absolute, you see? And what they do is they have rational meaning. There's a reason why God said that. And I just mentioned the idea. It's a paradox. The more you observe his laws, the greater is your statement that God is supreme. The greater your statement and belief that God is supreme, the greater is the fact that you can now attach yourself to him. And he is supreme. And he is existence. It's a paradox. But that's why. You believe that I am your existence. Guess what? You're going to enjoy that existence for eternity. You don't want to believe it. You want to believe that you're somebody in the sense that you could do whatever you want and violate my laws and so on. Guess what? You're not going to make it past the big judgment day and so on. So this is a very important theme of Purim, which I've illustrated, you know, constantly. And to answer the last question, why are there 2 days of Purim? Very interesting concept. Because really there should be only 1 day. Because it's one war. It just took place in 2 different days, that's all. So you don't have 2 days, right? And the answer is because Purim was unusual. Why? Because when they beat Amalek, right, and throughout Persia, fine. So that's a commemoration. Why? Because we won. We were saved. But it's unusual what the Jews did. They beat the Amalekis in Shushan. Shushan is the headquarters of Haman. That's where he was. That's the capital. So what the Jews realize is, wait a minute. Not only did God give us the ability to destroy the enemy, the Amalekis, now, but we destroyed the what? The headquarters of Amalek. And that's why you never hear of them afterwards. That was a murdik schus that God gave them the ability to wipe out, basically, Haman for history. Of course, every once in a while, there's some Gilgal of Haman, whatever. But basically, somebody who can identify himself as an Amaleki, which Haman, of course, did. Gogi, and so on. He knew he was Haman. Everybody knew he was from the descendant of the Amalekites and so on, right? You know. But when the Jews realized that God not only two schus, that we can destroy our enemies now, and we could destroy the whole concept of Amalek, so that requires another day. So Shushan wasn't just another victory. It was a victory over what's called, Kabbalistically, the Klipa of Amalek. And that was an incredible merit. So that is so great that we therefore commemorate those two ideas. That we wiped out the enemy, and we wiped out the whole concept of an individual who identifies as an Amaleki. We wiped that also. And that is Shushan. Because Shushan is the capital, and it is the headquarters. It's what's called the head of the snake. That we wiped out the head of the snake also. That deserves another day. And that's why Shushan Purim, in the end, is the greatest of all, and if you think about that, it's the greatest victory of the Jew, because it allowed the Jews to wipe out the head of the snake, not just a piece of the snake, and so on. Anyway, so I just wanted to answer that. Anyway, it's something to think about. what Purim is, it's beautiful to understand a holiday at a profound level, especially when it has such a a lesson to be learned about the human nature. And this is really a tremendous understanding of the essence of man. V'yisim kelokim, and you'll be like God. Boy, did that Satan, right? The Nochash, the snake, right? Boy, did he have us, as they called, pigeonholed. He knew exactly what's going to turn on Chava, which ultimately turned on Adam, to be like God. And Judaism is the exact opposite. You are not like me, don't even bother. On the contrary, the more you admit that you're nobody, and the reason why you're somebody is because you are my servant, that itself is how you'll get Olam Haba. Paradox. But that's what it is. Thank you.